Hey yo, what is a cypher?
This is our community.
You. The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast that brings you conversations with the most interesting people in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to writer, illustrator, action movie enthusiast, and all-around funny guy, Shay Serrano. Shay has written about hip-hop for the Houston Press, LA Weekly, Village Voice, and now as a staff writer at Grantland. As a resident of Houston, Texas, Shay has long been a supporter of that city's distinct and vibrant hip-hop scene. In fact, it was Shay's connections in the Houston scene that led him to Bun B from UGK, with whom he co-authored a rap-themed coloring and activity book in 2013. That book, like the rest of Shay's work about hip-hop, is both funny and on point. He manages to be simultaneously entertaining and insightful. Shay's most recent project is the cartoon series Football U, for MTV. He joined us via Skype from his home in Houston. Just a reminder before we start our talk with Shay Serrano. If you like The Cypher, find us on iTunes. From there, subscribe so that you'll never miss an episode. Also, rate the show and leave us a review. The more five-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. And now, preaching the gospel of the Three Migos, here's Shay Serrano. Welcome to The Cypher. I'm here with writer, illustrator, action movie enthusiast, Shay Serrano.
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah. For people who might not know you, can you tell us real quick a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Shay. I work at Grantland. I've been there for a few months now. Before then, I was freelancing for a bunch of different places. I've written for MTV and XXL and Rolling Stone and Vice and Complex and all those sorts of wonderful places. But yeah, now I'm at Grantland and I just, there you go.
Most of our audience might know you for being the author of Bun B's rap coloring and activity book.
Yeah. I did that in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
We did that. Yeah, that was cool.
So what exactly was that for the few people who haven't seen it?
It was basically exactly what it sounds like. It was a coloring book, except it was filled with rappers instead of like bears riding bicycles or whatever's in a regular coloring book.
What was Bun's involvement?
He was like the figurehead for it. He put his name on it. He came to me, you know, the year prior and said he wanted to do a book. So we were sort of bouncing around what could be fun to do. And we came up with that one. So he was like, you know, he was the guy that gave it legitimacy. If I would have done it just by myself, people would have said, oh, he's just making fun of these rappers or whatever. With his name on there, you know, you can't say that anymore.
Yeah, he has this sort of universal or near universal love and respect amongst like artists that is pretty much unparalleled.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And he was super helpful because for the book, we had to get everybody's permission if we wanted to put them in there. We didn't want to just do it without asking anybody. So all the people in the book, we had to contact them and, hey, do you want to get a book? If so, you have to sign this form, whatever. So it was kind of hard to get in contact with these guys, just doing it by myself. And I would text Bun, like, hey, I can't get a hold of Drake. Can you help me out here? And then like an hour later, I get an email back, you know, all the stuff situated and everything. So it wouldn't have come off without his help. We would have had like three people in there or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's great.
And I noticed that it started with a Tumblr before it was a book, but the Tumblr caught fire basically instantly. Like within a couple of weeks, you had, you know, artists responding and saying, hey, can you draw me? And it seemed like the book deal happened almost instantaneously.
Yeah, the plan was always to try to get a book deal. But it seemed like an easier sell if I could just show these people the pictures. So we started the Tumblr and then, yeah, it spread real quick. It took like a week before it went viral and then it was all over everywhere.
Who was the first artist other than Bun to who you remember being supportive of the Tumblr, saying, hey, this is cool, or can you draw me, or that was great, or whatever?
I think Danny Brown, actually.
He used your drawing as his Twitter avatar.
Yeah. He was. I started getting all these messages, and I looked on there, and sure enough, he had grabbed it and put it up there. And Danny Brown's people are super cool. The Fool's Gold people. Mm-hmm. We had done this thing with MTV where we made like pumpkin carvings for Halloween. And I made a Danny Brown pumpkin carving, and then they actually like made a video of them doing the pumpkin, and they set it up. He was the first guy, and then from there just sort of spread around. It was exciting to watch happen.
That's excellent. And one thing I noticed, speaking of Tumblr, was that you got a ton of support from other people who had Tumblrs.
Yeah, it spread around. Actually, the people that run Tumblr were helping out as well. I got an email from them saying that they had watched it, you know, sort of grow, and they wanted to help. So they featured it on their little dashboard one day. That was really what put it over. When they put it on their main page or dashboard or whatever that thing is called, we went from like 4,000 to 3,000 in a few hours. So they were cool. And then especially when the book came out, they were helping with that. And they've got Rachel. Her job is to transition the tumblers into the books. She was fantastic. She's still helpful.
That's great. And what was it like becoming a part of that kind of Tumblr community? Like, had you used it before? Were you familiar with the site at all? Or
I had used it, set up this other Tumblr that went viral. And so I was sort of familiar with how it was going to roll out once it started rolling out. But this one was bigger than the last one. So, you know.
What was the last Tumblr? Was that the Drinking Bad one? Or what was that?
Oh, I think Drinking Bad came after the coloring book. That one went viral too. You know what, my favorite part of when that one spread around, or people would write about it, they would say, oh, you might remember this, the same guy made the rap coloring book Tumblr, like that was neat. But the one before both of those, it was called Sex Questions from Seventh Graders.
Sex Questions from Seventh Graders.
And it was this thing that I had done where I teach at a middle school here in Houston, and part of the curriculum, you have to go over like the reproductive system, and all the kids were super nervous about, they wanted to ask questions, but they were, you know, they don't want to ask them in front of everybody. So we had this box in the class with some index cards, and they would write down their questions on the card and put it in there. And then I would try to answer a few of them after class. This was like several years ago, and I was cleaning out my classroom. I was moving out, and I found the box with all the cards in it. So, and I was reading through them, and they're super just goofy cards. And I just posted pictures of them up on Tumblr, and they spread around like crazy too.
Nice. And so about this whole kind of going viral thing, since it's happened to you a few times, you know, first with Sex Questions from Seventh Graders, and then the, you know, the coloring book, and then the Drinking Bad, which was super funny. It was basically Drake drawn into scenes from Breaking Bad.
Right.
Which is about as funny and absurd as it sounds. Have you managed to figure out anything about going viral? What's likely to do it? Are there any principles or anything? Or is it just like each time it was a surprise?
I was anticipating it happening with each of those. With the Sex Questions one, that was the one I was like not 100% certain. But yeah, it seems like if you want something to go viral, it's got to be an idea that's easy to understand, and hopefully it has some sort of art you can attach to it. And really, that's it. I mean, it's just got to be a fun thing. That's all you need. It's not science or anything.
When the coloring book came out, there was a big, you know, media push around it. You did, you know, interviews, TV appearances, that kind of stuff. What was it like going from being the interviewer, you know, writing about music, which we'll get into how you started that in a minute, to being the interviewee?
That was weird. Not like super weird. Most of the people that were doing the interviews were people that I knew because I had been writing about music for a while. So these are, you know, acquaintances of mine. So, but like when I did when I went on TV, that was sort of strange. I'd never done anything like that.
What's up, guys? It's your girl, Kai Meyer. Okay, he's a rap legend, a college professor, a foodie, and a sports fanatic. And now Bun B is adding publications to his list. That's right, Bun's got a new hip-hop coloring and activity book. It's a project he put together with Houston illustrator and award-winning music critic Shea Serrano. The guy's got me tuned in to their new colorful creation. Check it out.
When you're used to asking the questions, you sort of understand what they're going to ask. And so I was, you know, able to be at least a little bit prepared. But yeah, it was definitely strange being the one that they were looking at instead of doing the looking.
Speaking of your career as a journalist, you started it basically out of necessity, right? You were looking for kind of a second job in addition to teaching.
Yeah. You must have done your research. That is correct.
What made you decide on that as opposed to anything else?
Well, my wife was pregnant with our twins. We got three kids. This was 7 years, 8 years ago. She was pregnant with the twins. And we had saved up money to stop for her to like stay home for 6 months with the kids when they came. Some crazy stuff happened. She ended up not being able to work anymore, like midway through the pregnancy, 4 months in. So we used up all of our money that we had saved. And then I'm just the only, you know, now I'm the only income and I'm a teacher. They don't, you know, we don't make a terrible amount of money. So yeah, I was trying to find a second job and all the places I was applying, like to be a waiter or to work at as a stocker in a grocery store, like these type of jobs, nobody would hire me because I already had a job. I already had a full-time job and they're saying, you know, we can't call you when we need you type of thing. I said, all right, that's fine. So I was trying to just find a job I could do from the house around, you know, my own schedule. And I said, all right, well, let me try it. I'll just be a writer then. It was like the only thing I could think of. So I didn't have any experience writing. I read a little bit and I just started calling the newspapers in town and telling them I was this new writer that moved here and I was trying to find work. And they were like, why are you calling me? That's not how this works anymore. So then I was like, all right, I'm trying to email. And, you know, I just kept on, you know, I started a little newspaper here in Houston and then everything, you know, things went well and it grew from there. And here we are. I mean, that was 7 years ago and my wife still has not been back to work. You know, things worked out pretty well.
That's awesome. And, you know, a lot of your pieces, you started out, actually, one of the things I read, I guess you'd been writing a few years by that point, but, you know, there wasn't just the kind of like first person pieces you're known for. You also did some reported stuff and some kind of more straight music journalism. There was a great piece about discrimination in Houston nightlife that you co-wrote, I guess, a while back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was when I was with the Houston mm-hmm. Press. And that's really where I learned to write. That's the alt weekly here in town. They're tied with all the Village Voice papers like LA Weekly and Village Voice in New York and all that. And, yeah, they got a super strong editor team over there. But we did that story. I had been the nightlife columnist at that paper for probably 2 years, 3 years, something like that. And we did that one. And we actually won some awards for that. And that was, yeah, that was helpful because now I've got all this stuff that I do and people know, oh, he does a funny guy and he does these goofy things. But then I also have this in my background that I know how to report a story or whatever. So, you know, that's helpful for other things I get to work on.
Yeah. And your drawing abilities has definitely come out in some of the, you know, some things as well. In addition to writing, you've been doing a lot of illustration, you know, stuff for Complex and Vice and even like the drawing, you know, rappers as Game of Thrones characters and things like that for MySpace. When did that kind of stuff start after the coloring book when people were like, oh, he can draw too? Or were you doing that beforehand?
That was afterward. I don't know why I didn't think about that before. Before the coloring book, I never drawn anything or put anything up there. I did the book, and then all of a sudden, everybody wants stuff. Like, I don't know, you know, can you do this? Can you do that? And I didn't know how to do the coloring book before I did the coloring book. All of the art stuff that goes up now, I didn't know how to do it before I learned how to do it. So I was just telling everybody, yeah, I could do that, I could do that, and I figured it out. But yeah, I should have thought about that. I mean, that might have helped my career. I might have been 2 years further ahead than I am now, shoot. Because once that happened, then... You know, that stuff is the stuff that really sort of spreads around. It's easy to share and it's, you know, it's cool.
One thing, I was reading something about you and you said like your dad was an artist and you just kind of assumed everyone could draw, that, you know, it wasn't anything special.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. He's really, I mean, he's like a legit artist and I was just always doing goofy cartoons or whatever. But because I was around him and he was drawn and then I was drawn too, it just seemed like, oh, this is just a thing people can do. Mm-hmm. And now I have sons and they can draw as well. So I'm, you know, glad I at least passed something good on to them.
When did you first kind of realize, hey, you know, not everyone can do this?
Probably like middle school or something. In elementary, everybody draws the same. You get to middle school is when people are, you know, you're actually going to try to do some stuff. And I was watching other people like, this is that's the worst shit I've ever seen in my life. What's going on?
Nice. And, you know, you mentioned your kids. You have twins. Are they old enough now to read some of the stuff you've written about them in the past?
I know they know how to read. Mm. I don't know, they don't go on the internet, so that, you know, they have not seen anything. They've actually done some stuff. When I was with LA Weekly, we did, like, they drew some pictures of rappers, and we did this whole silly thing around that. And they've actually had like stuff published, which is neat. But no, they don't read any of the stuff that I do yet. They don't even think it's like a cool thing. Well, I took them when the coloring book came out. Mm-hmm. Went like the day of to the bookstore. They had this whole setup at Barnes and Noble, and they just were looking at it like, yeah, okay, whatever. And then, you know, can you buy me this Big Nate book? Let's get Big Nate out of here. Like, this is why are you not proud of this right now?
Right. And we actually had Adam Mansbach, who wrote Go the Fuck to Sleep, on the show not long ago. And he was just like, yeah, kids aren't impressed by that. They're like, I wrote 5 books this week and I can't even read yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you still teaching? I know you're still a middle school teacher.
I am. Yeah, I teach 8th grade here. I've been there for about 10 years now.
A lot of the stuff you've written has been, you know, this whole sort of life and times thing you did. I think it was for LA Weekly, right, where you kind of write about your experiences in the classroom and different things that would happen and chaperoning dances and so forth.
Yeah, that was it was a syndicated column, so it ran in a bunch of the Village Voice papers.
Yeah. Did those kids ever read any of the stuff you wrote about them?
They did. Yeah. I tried to share it with them, especially if I mentioned like a specific thing that happened to a specific kid. Because all of that stuff, it's always like a positive thing, you know? And so I've written about a few of them or different things that have happened. So I share it. I did the football thing for ESPN or for Grantland. And we did a video all at the end. We had like an actual guy come out and we did this whole big thing. And I shared it with all those guys. And so it's neat for them to be able to see, you know, and they get to keep hold of that.
I do have to ask, whatever happened to the Lunchfest Club? This was a group of 5 kids who ate lunch in your classroom every day. And you kind of typed them as, you know, the boss and the second in command and the loud one and the louder one.
Right. With those ones, what ended up happening is one of the girls, the main one, she was this older kid. She had been flunked, held back a few times. And man, she just had this terrible life story. Like they literally put her in a basket and put her on a doorstep. Her mother did, and just never saw her again. And the dad lived in the neighborhood, but he never was a part of her life. Like, it was just this terrible thing. But she was older. She was 16. All the other kids are 14. So she was more mature than them, and they sort of followed her around. But she ended up dropping out of school like halfway through 8th grade, and she just ran away. And we didn't see her again for a few months. And then in 9th grade, she actually contacted me and another teacher, and just to let us know that she was still alive and whatever. But so that's what happened to her. One of the other girls, like her second person, sort of followed in her footsteps. And then the other guys, they went on and graduated to 9th grade.
One of your other recurring things was a column called Why This Song Sucks. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that's kind of tailor-made to get pretty insane responses, and you actually printed a pretty nuts response from a One Direction fan who was mad that you had you'd said something about one of their songs.
Oh yeah. That was the first time that they were actually like coming after me. Like, them little white girls are like terrifying. They were all in my like Twitter mentions, just thousands and thousands one day, telling me that I should die. And I'm like, oh my god, these girls are like super thugs. They're not playing around.
Wow. No joke. Other than the One Direction piece, what were some other memorable responses you got from that column? Do you remember anything?
I don't remember too many specifics. It was always sort of the same thing about how terrible I am. And that sort of, you know, why are y'all paying this guy to do this sort of thing? Most people understood that it was just a silly thing. Like, we did the Grinch song for around Christmas time. We did that one, and we were calling it, it was hate speech and all of this stuff. And people understood, you know, that it was playful, but man, some of them were really, really mean spirited about it. But I guess that's what happens when you say something that's funny.
And you're in Houston. I know you grew up in San Antonio, but you're in Houston now. And Houston's such a crazy city when it comes to rap music. We had, you know, a while back, we had Lance Scott Walker on, who wrote the Houston rap, coffee table book and got real deep into the scene there. It's almost basically got its own entire rap canon that's like separate from, you know, the best of all time albums you might expect to find, you know, elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. It grew on its own out of necessity. And then even after it popped in 2004 into 2005, it stayed within itself. You know, all the guys here, they're still here, and they're still. Mike Jones literally just put out a new mixtape this morning, and they're all sorted, you know, still doing their.
Sorry, who?
Mike Jones.
Anyway, one thing I was curious about is the status of Zero, because like I love him on the low. I think he's better than Pac. and you know, I can't say that, you know, on either of the coasts because people get too upset.
Right.
What is his status like in Houston? I get the feeling that he's kind of like one step away from having, you know, statues all over town.
Yeah, he's pretty close to that. He was much more popular several years ago. He slowed down his output. He got into some contract disputes and they were sort of holding all this stuff from coming out. But yeah, he's a cult hero here in Houston. And a lot of people have said, so, you know, something sort of similar to he's better than Pop. I think the easiest comparison to draw between him would be to Nate Dogg, just because they both do the singing thing.
Mm.
They don't give a damn unless you're breaking your back for them.
Yeah.
But they won't help you out the situations you in.
Yeah.
They act like they a shoulder to lean on. They listen to your problems and they grin. This ain't living.
Hey. OG, could you tell me how to find some good weed?
But yeah, in Houston, he's pretty cool. I met him. I have been like, you know, you write about rap music in Houston. You've mentioned him quite a few times. So just from regularity, I built up this thing about how he was this superhero and like super scary and all this stuff. I've been doing that for a couple of years. And then I ran into him. They were shooting a video downtown and I showed up and he was there. And it was the first time I'd ever seen him in person. And it was like super overwhelming. And so I walked up to say hello. He was with this other rapper named Trey. And Trey, I had known for a little bit by then, so I said hello to him, and Zero put his like a fist out for me to dap him up, and I was so nervous that I grabbed it like a door and I just shook it like I was trying to open the door to his heart, and he just pulled it away, and that was the only time we ever talked.
That seems about right for the only time ever to talk to Zero.
Yeah So that same day we were leaving. And I was telling him, oh, I'm sure I did this or that, this or that. And I had drawn a picture of him and I sent it to him on Twitter. And he used it, he posted it, and then he put it on his Instagram, was using it as like his avatar or something one day. And so I told him, like, the picture that you had up there the last week, that I did that. And he just was like, oh, yeah, I stole that bitch like a motherfucker. And then that was it. That was the only thing he said. He didn't say thank you. He didn't say he liked it. He just told me he stole it. And so I was proud to have something stolen from Zero. Like, that's a rite of passage.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the Houston rappers you're messing with now is Maxo.
Oh yeah, I like him a lot.
Yeah, even though you're not allowed to play him in your house, right?
That is correct. He is somehow he's too violent.
Well, he had that line. What was it about shooting when he's shooting your car, aiming for the car seat or something?
223 strapped like a motherfucker in a SUV, black like a motherfucker, aiming for the car seat. I'm a crazy motherfucker.
And that was the line that did it right there.
Yeah.
I was listening to it. I like his stuff. His last tape he put out was really good. And I was playing it for my wife. And he put a new song out and I showed it to her. I played it for her. And she asked, did he just say? And I said, yeah, he said that. She was like, nope, that's it. That's enough. We're not listening to that. And so I can only listen to him in my headphones. I can't listen to him around the kids. That was, you know, can't shoot a baby.
Right.
Too much.
Right. I can see how that might be over the line. What other Houston artists are you messing with now?
Ooh, like as far as the lesser known guys.
Yeah.
There is, I like Maxo, of course. I like this guy named Dobeezy. He's very good. Beat King, who's sort of, he's on the radio and stuff down here. I don't think he's spread out too far.
Yeah. Well, Beat King did that great tape with another one of our past guests, Gangster Boo.
Yes. That was probably like my third favorite tape of 2014. I really enjoyed that one. There's also this guy named Propane. He did a song called Two Rounds with Rich Homie Quan.
I was in Houston for a minute, now I'm back in town. Rich Homie, baby!
All it takes is one text, asking me where I'm at.
told her, baby, I'm on one, but your destination is next. Now I'm coming down on that freeway, that UGK on my dick. Got that take it off on replay, like Pimp C said.
That spread around down here, but his tape was really good. This other guy named Dustin Prestige, who nobody ever talks about, D-Lo and Les, and just, I mean, every city has their guys that they sort of root for, and we've got six or seven of them that I'm, you know, cheering on, hoping they make it.
Yeah. I did want to get into the piece that initially made me think about calling you was a Christmas theme piece you did called Three Wise Migos.
Yes. Oh, I like that. I like the way that came out a lot.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about creating that, because it's like, it's kind of a Three Wise Men parody featuring, you know, one of the guys from Migos trying to find the new king of rap. And he sort of eventually realizes that, you know, it's himself. And so it's like, it's funny, but, you know, it's also like sort of a lot of commentary about the state of hip hop in there. And, you know, actually a fair amount of heart in the middle of all the satire.
Yeah, that, you know, that, you know how that came up? There's a guy and he lives in Houston. His name is Idris, but he has, his internet handle is Dean, like D-E-E-N 8 or something like that. And I follow him on Twitter. He's real funny, this Nigerian dude. And I follow him on Twitter, and he's like a secret writer. He works as a lawyer or something like that. And he's a secret rap writer. And so he never uses his real name. I don't even know his last name. That might not even be his real name. But I was following him, and he sent out a tweet, and it just said that. It said, Three Wise, .. Migos. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, we have to make this. So I messaged him and told him, hey, let's make this an actual story. And he's like, all right, cool, I'm with it. So him and I sort of traded emails back and forth, and we built up what we wanted the story to look like. He's like a big Migos fan, so he had all the information I needed. And he gave me the stuff we were going for. And then I just wrote it all out. And then the art for that, which I was really excited about, that's from this guy in Dallas named Arturo Torres. And he's the guy that I used. He's the illustrator of the new book, the new rap book that I'm doing. So I was trying to like transition him into, let's get you, he had done flyers and stuff, but he had never done anything like for any publication. So I wanted to start putting you out there. So people know what your art looks like, because it's so fantastic. Mm. And yeah, it all just sort of came together over probably like 2 days. We were able to get all the pieces done and get everything written out. And I was super excited when Migos was tweeting it and sharing the pictures. And that's what we were sort of hoping was going to happen. And then lo and behold, it did.
That's really great. And you mentioned in passing your new book. So you're not doing the illustrations for it?
No, I hired a guy to do them. I saw him. He had done a flyer for this other group called The Outfit.
Oh, I know The Outfit Texas. Yeah.
Yes, those guys. So yeah. He did a flyer for them, and they posted it. They were out on some show, and I saw it. And as soon as I saw it, I said, oh, this is the exact kind of art that I want. Because it's not comic book art, but it's not, I don't even know how to describe it. It kind of looks like the people, it kind of doesn't. It's real sketchy. It has this great texture to it. As soon as I saw it, I said, this is exactly what I need for the book, because that's how I was trying to shape up the book. It has all the facts and all of this, you know, boring stuff in there that people pretend like they want to read about, but it also is full of a bunch of jokes and silly things, and so I wanted the art to reflect that. And man, he did a great job. I was so excited about when he was sending me the stuff and we were putting it all together. It just looks amazing.
Nice. And so what is the book? What can you tell us about it?
The book, it's the same publishers that did the rap coloring book. The rap coloring book did real well. We sold a whole bunch of copies. So they wanted to do another book, not necessarily a coloring book, but they wanted another rap book. And so they actually had the idea already. Basically, the way it works is rap has been around roughly started in 1979 and goes forward. You can argue it's been since before that, and a lot of people will. But 1979 was like, this is when we're going to call this the beginning of rap. Mm-hmm. And so for every year from 1979 to 2014, that's 35 years. Every year I'm going to pick a song. We're going to call we're going to say this is the most important song of that year. And then we're going to write about it. So it's 35 different songs, one per year, the most important one. And each chapter is just about that song, and it has artwork. and in there. So we started with, in 1979, with, of course, Rapper's Delight, which was like the first real big rap song.
Not Personality Jock.
You just clap your hands and you stomp your feet because you're listening to the sound of the shims you need. I'm the K-I-N-G, the G-I-M, King Jim the Third, and I am him. Just me, Fat Fat, and the crew, we're doing it all just for you. We're strong as an ox and tall as a tree. We can rock it so viciously. We drove the high...
Didn't go for the underdog?
No, I did not. I did not. We went for the main one. And then it just goes forward from there. One song per year, the most important song. And I thought the idea was cool when they presented it to me, just because if you do it that way, it opens up a different conversation than what are the most popular songs or what are the most important songs in all of hip hop. Like, you're not allowed to pick. In 1994, for example, that's the year that Biggie had his album and Nas had his album. And now you can only pick one song from either one of those as the most important. And so it just has a couple of different conversations in there that might not have otherwise taken place.
Yeah. It's funny you said 94. I feel like that's kind of a big year for you in a lot of ways. You had that whole matrix of albums that came out that year that you did.
Yeah. 1994 is my favorite year in rap, if I have to pick just one year for the collection of music that came out. There was a lot of interesting stuff going on that year. And all of the years in that era were super important or super powerful. They all had big stuff going on. Starting in 88, which is, you know, another big one. And that's when Straight Outta Compton came out. And then from there, it was just like boom, 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 boom. All these big, big hits that were doing big things in rap, establishing these new branches. And yeah, but 1994, that's take all the albums from then. And I don't think any year can beat it.
And it was also, according to something else you wrote, the apotheosis of R&B, that R&B will never be that good again as it was that year.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much going on in 1994. And then that's also the year, I don't know, maybe it's just because that's when I was, by 1994, I was already a teenager. And so I was beginning to experience this stuff as it was happening. So maybe it just means more to me than it should, but yeah, who knows?
Do you think R&B can ever reach those heights?
Nah, not a chance. Radio's not built for that sort of thing anymore. And you certainly aren't going to have the groups that you had back then, especially if you got like the little kid groups like ABC type stuff going on, or Crisscross, or Crisscross, not R&B, but you had these young kids that were making this interesting music. And that doesn't, I mean, we had the Hot Cheetos and Takis.
Hot Cheetos and Takis, Hot Cheetos and Takis. I can't get enough of these Hot Cheetos and Takis. Got my fingers stained red and I can't like get them on me. You can catch me in my coat.
About as close as we got.
Very cool. And since we just celebrated a new year, I have to ask, what trends, musical otherwise, are you hoping will go away in 2015?
Oh, I just hope that J. Cole goes away. My main hope. Him, and I guess second to that would be just the whole Iggy Azalea thing. She's super frustrating and annoying, and I just don't like her. I think music's doing cool stuff right now. It's very weird. And it's just, people are trying new things and they're trying to find what that next step is going to be. And it's fun to watch.
Yeah. The J. Cole thing, I know you constantly rag on him in your pieces and stuff like that. And I was curious what you think now that the new album's, you know, sold extremely well, is getting good reviews, and he's showing up at anti-police violence rallies in, you know, unassuming ways and getting good press for that. In some ways, he seems kind of untouchable. Is that disappointing to you?
Nah, I don't mind him being successful. That just, he's got to be successful for not liking him to be a fun thing. If everybody understood that he was terrible, then it wouldn't be interesting to say he's terrible. It wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't get to make that argument. So I need for him to become a big thing so I can say that he sucks.
What is it about him in particular that sticks in your craw a little bit?
He, to me, is just, he's just corny, I think. I think that's the main thing. He positions himself as this intellect. I'm a smart guy and listen to what I'm saying and how deep it is. But it's never really, he never speaks anything beyond a lot of cliches. And to me, that's what it seems like. I think I remember reading this thing that this guy Nas wrote, who's this great writer.
Sorry, that's N-O-Z for our listeners, yeah.
And I think this might have been like 2 years ago, or might have even been longer when J. Cole first started popping. But he made this comparison about how, because a lot of people have likened J. Cole to Nas, and he was saying, with, you know, Nas was very good at, he could just sit on the stoop and see all of the stuff that was happening, and he was able to rap about it better than anybody had ever done before and anybody had ever done since, as far as just processing what's going on and the implications of that. But J. Cole never does that. There aren't ancillary characters in his music. It's always just, this is what's happening to me. I have a crooked smile. I feel this, I feel that. This is how it's affecting me. It doesn't extend beyond himself. And so it just doesn't make me feel anything when I listen to it. There's nothing in there for me.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned Crooked Smile. That song always bugged me a little bit. I think it's in this long, grand, somewhat unfortunate tradition of songs of men telling women how they should feel about themselves.
Love yourself, girl, and nobody will. No, you a woman, I don't know how you deal with all the pressure to look impressive and go out in heels. I feel for you. Killing yourself to find a man that'll kill for you.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, what are you doing, man? Like, I don't know. He's just a goofy guy.
Moving from that to something much better, I know, you know, you worked with Bun, and, you know, you love, rightfully, Riding Dirty. But you didn't always love UGK. It took you a while to get into them.
Yeah, I didn't understand them. I wasn't interested in listening to them when I was a kid. And that makes sense because they don't make music for kids. The stuff that they were talking about didn't resonate with me. I didn't understand it. I wasn't able to process it. I didn't grow up where they grew up. I barely even grew up how they grew up. Like, when San Antonio, where we lived, it was like all these poor Mexicans, but it was not a lot of crime. It was not a lot of drug use. It was just, this is our community. And I didn't understand what they were talking about. And then I got older and I was able to see sort of some of this stuff firsthand. And then then it made sense. Then I understood it and I felt what they were saying. And it's just beautiful music, man.
And in addition to rap and sports, obviously, since you work for the Grantland, the ESPN affiliate, you are also a huge fan of action movies and basically anything with a fight scene. You've ranked, you know, your top movie fight scenes, your top movie troops and things like that.
Yeah.
What kind of response have you gotten from those pieces?
It's largely been positive. You get a few people that they'll say, oh, you missed this one thing, so this 5,000 words you wrote is stupid because you missed one part, my favorite thing. But like when I did the soldier thing, the troops thing, that one did really well. I actually did an interview afterwards with the guys, with some NPR people. They wanted to talk about it. And so we did that. And, oh, that was like a terrible interview. Because most of the time I'm used to doing like radio stuff or whatever. I'm used to talking to people that are as smart as I am. So I know what they're going to ask. These guys were super, super smart. And it wasn't just that they're like, they know everything about everything, but they knew everything about wars. And they had all this history. And they're asking me questions and I was trying to answer it. And I could just feel the dumbness coming out of my mouth. And I couldn't stop it. It just kept on going. But yeah, the response has been good. That was probably one of my favorite ones because I had help from actual soldiers and troops that were participating, And then when it came out, they sent me like nice messages. Oh, this was well done. I mean, I got big, my people and family were in the military, and I've got some of them still in there. And it's just, I didn't want to mess that one up. That was important.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, the kind of response you got from service members to that piece.
That was all positive. All the stuff that was sent directly to me. I don't know about it out there just existing, but the stuff that came to me was probably the first time it was all positive, and I felt good.
Very cool. And since you're doing stuff with Grantland now as a staff writer, what's the process for that like? Do you kind of write about whatever you like, or do you have to go sort of pitch it to an editor? Like, what is that like now being on staff as opposed to being a freelancer?
Being on staff was a bigger transition than I thought it was going to be. Because with freelancing, I can just pitch my stories that I think I want to write whenever I want to do it. And that's basically how it works. I can set it up to where I'm going to do 5 things this week, and then I'm going to take 2 weeks off because I got my checks coming in. I'm good to go. But with staff, as a staff writer, now I'm responsible for a certain number of things per week, and there's always something due. And it was a pressure I wasn't used to. So I had to sort of transition into that. But the way it works there is I have 3 editors I report to, one for sports, one for music, one for like movies and TV and stuff like that. And so usually once a week, towards the end of the week, I'll send out an email to them saying, these are the ideas I had for stuff that I can do next week. And then they'll tell me, okay, this is good, this is bad, this is how we can fix this and make this better. And then, you know, now I know going into the weekend what stuff I have to do next, the following week, and I'm able to work on it. And it's just the same process. After I got my schedule down, and I knew what they were looking for from me, and I knew the best ways and best times to ask them about it. And then it became easier, and it's like the pressure's still there, but it feels different. It's like a positive thing. They're sort of encouraging you to do this or that, and it's worked out nicely.
I was listening to an interview with you where you were really emphatic about how aspiring writers should never write for free. Why do you feel so strongly about that?
Yeah, that's just because it's a job. It's what you know. You want to make a living at something, you can't start out doing it for free. You never do a free job anywhere for anybody else. So don't do it with writing, because what you ask for is usually what you're going to get. So if you just say, I'm going to do it for free, then of course they're just going to let you do it for free. I was always trying to avoid that. That was a big thing that a lot of people ask for, especially with all the different websites and stuff. Oh, I'll write for this website or that website, but they don't pay me anything. Then you're not doing anything. You're not learning anything. They're not trying to help you or teach you. They're not investing in you. With the Grantland people, I know that they're investing in me because they take the time and help me out and tell me give me this different advice or whatever. It's been the same way with all these different places I've written for. There's an exchange there, an exchange of ideas. So just never ever write for free.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because that's becoming something closer to the norm with, like you said, the vast amount of websites, and everyone needs content, and there's so many people willing to do it.
Yeah, there are. It seems like everybody wants to be a writer. Not obviously everybody, but a bunch of people do, and it's sad that not everybody's going to be able to make it to where they want to be able to make it. But if you want to be the one that makes it, then you're going to have to do stuff that's sometimes uncomfortable, and having a conversation about what money's going to be paid to you for some people is uncomfortable, but it's just a thing that needs to happen.
Winding down, I wanted to ask you, one of your favorite movie stars, Jean-Claude Van Damme, was in the news the other day. So it was a Kickboxer remake, and they were unable to pay people for the last week of filming. They claimed some financing fell out, and the union was upset about that, and they're trying to work it out. How would you feel if the remake ended up not coming out?
Well, 2 things. First, that's the one exception where you should work for free, is if Jean-Claude Van Damme is remaking Kickboxer and you're on that staff, go ahead and knock that out. But 2, I don't mind. If it doesn't get remade, then that's okay. I still have the original one. There's no way the new one's going to be better than the original. They just don't make action movies like that anymore. So I got all that stuff. I literally just watched Bloodsport like 2 days ago. So I'm straight.
What specifically do you mean they don't make action movies like that anymore? It seems like there's certainly, you know, no shortage of like fighting scenes and, you know, crazy effects and people on wires and things like that. What was different about the sort of era of movies you're talking about?
That era of movie was special because they were putting, it wasn't like this big budget behind these movies. There was a little bit of budget there, but they were receiving wide releases. And well, the thing in the movie that was always appealing to me is they were allowing these guys to be, for lack of a better word, they were allowing them to be bad. They didn't have to be these great actors. They just were these guys that were, you rooted for, and they would say corny things and do goofy stuff. And it just was always fun to watch. Like you've got the, all these Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, he always has all these goofy lines in there that he's going to say after he kills you.
Sweetheart, we're married.
Consider that a divorce.
Like, that doesn't happen anymore. If it happens, it's part of a joke, right? Like, remember Austin Powers did that one movie and the guy's head came, like, his head got eaten off, and then he said, like, five jokes in a row about, oh, he'll never be the head of a major, like, this sort of thing.
Not a good time to lose one's head.
Oh, indeed.
That's not the way to get ahead in life.
No.
It's a shame he wasn't more headstrong. He'll never be the head of a major corporation.
Okay, that'll do.
Okay.
That was happening back then. It wasn't a joke. It was like a legit thing that they were saying. It was part of the movie, and it was fun to be a part of that. If they don't do that in movies anymore, they don't kick a guy into a volcano and then say something cool. Like, if it does, it's just ironic in this sarcastic sort of sense. So I like that they were doing that back then authentically.
Very cool. And finally, other than the, well, first of all, does the new book, your new book have a title yet?
It does. I don't know if we're allowed to say it. It doesn't come out until next October, I believe.
Okay.
We're a ways away. But no, it's cool, man. Working on a new book, I didn't realize how much work it was going to be. The rap coloring book, I did that. I drew all those pictures in like a week, literally over spring break. I took a break from work. We got a week off. I drew everything I needed in those 5 days. This one, I didn't anticipate how much work was going to go into researching. Every chapter I've got to learn, I had to learn all about that era, basically. And then not just that one, but what happened the year before, what happened the year after, and how did this song sort of affect the trajectory of rap. I was trying to connect the dot, make one straight line from 1979 to 2014, and they're all, it's like following a tree up to the top. We've got all these different branches, and I'm trying to find the strongest one to get to the next spot. And that was heavy. It was a lot of research. But it was cool because now I feel like this is the most I've ever known about rap in my whole life. So shoot.
Are you so you're going to be killer at cocktail parties now?
It's going to be super annoying, I'm sure. My wife is already tired of hearing me like, oh, did you know that they made, that Kanye West made Gold Digger? He made it for Shauna and not for, like, all these stupid little tiny facts like that.
Nice. What, other than the new book, what are you working on?
I'm just trying to finish that up. That one will be done in about 2 weeks, I'm guessing. And then I've got, you know, all the stuff planned for Grantland that we've got going on. There's a thing that's going to be out soon on MTV that I worked on earlier in 2014. It's a cartoon about college football. And that one will be on MTV. I wrote the script for like 5 or 6 episodes there. And so I believe they're going to start rolling out all the promo stuff for that this week or next week, if I'm not mistaken. They just sent an email out with all the information. But I'm excited to see what that looks like. I've seen it on the computer. They've sent me, I got to watch an episode. It was all finished and all put together. And I've got that. I've got the Grantland stuff, which is exciting, and probably another book that we're sort of talking about already, a third one with the same company.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to all of that, and hopefully, if Brian Bosworth makes another movie, you'll be right on the cutting edge, ready to tell us all about it.
I will be right there. Yes.
Excellent. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us, Shay. I really appreciate it.
All right, homie.
Homie. As you heard from the interview, and know if you've read pretty much anything he's ever written, Shay is a very, very funny dude. But to me, the most interesting parts of the interview were when he was talking about the Houston rap scene. That scene is almost an entirely different ecosystem from the rest of hip-hop, and it was really great to hear someone's view of it from the inside. Also, the thing I said about Zero was not hyperbole. I really do think he's better than Pac. Zero, if you're listening, get at me. We'd love to have you as a guest. As someone who does a little bit of music writing myself, it was also great to hear Shay's thoughts on his career arc. I especially dug his thoughts on writers not working for free. The idea that creative work is work and should be paid like any other job is a sadly all too uncommon one today. Just a side note, shortly after we recorded this interview, Shay announced that Ice-T would be writing the foreword to his new book. His tweets about it were especially funny. Next week, we talk to legendary producer and songwriter Rocky Ford. Rocky, while he was at Billboard, was the first person to write about hip-hop for a mainstream publication back in 1978. He's also responsible for writing Curtis Blow's huge hits, The Breaks and Christmas Rappin'. And if that wasn't enough, he was also a mentor to the likes of Nelson George and Russell Simmons. We talk about all of that, and he dishes a ton of dirt about the record business during the disco era. Even if you didn't already know Rocky's name, you definitely know his work, and you're going to love hearing from him. If you like The Cypher and want us to keep delivering the same high-quality shows you've come to expect, rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Let me know what you thought of this week's show. Hit me with ideas for future guests. Anything you'd want to talk about. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sitaro.
It didn't resonate with me. I didn't understand it. I wasn't able to process it.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
But they knew everything about wars.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Somehow he's too violent.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
One time I was reading a Chuck Klosterman book and I got an email from Chuck Klosterman at the same time. I was reading it on my phone and then bing, it came up.